Hello, everyone. Happy December 20th or December 21st or whenever you're hearing this. We're back with another episode. This is the Mississippi Mass Choir. And today's episode is going to be a little different. We're going to talk about some stuff that you need to know. But I did an interview with a guy. Now, super nervous about this interview, but we're going strong on this podcast. We're starting off strong. Bringing out the big hitters. Did an interview with a guy from a podcast I listened to. I've been listening to a ton over the last, 2 years maybe? And, I was nervous. You know, when you listen to a podcast and you hear someone talk for hours and hours in your head, and then suddenly, like, that person, you know, you're interacting with that person, it's really weird. It's a really, really weird situation. But anyways, Hunter Motz and Brian Callen. It used to be the Brian Callen Show, and now it's Mixed Mental Arts. And we talk a little bit about, thinking about your brain, about a lot of science that hasn't really been adopted by most people, or hasn't been adopted even necessarily by the scientific community. Just a lot of book ideas that need to get out, a lot of important books that have been really influential in my life, but more importantly in Hunter and Brian's life. And they talk about the books. Hunter talks about the books, talks about what they're trying to do. They created this this movement, this thing, this place called Mixed Mental Arts. It's basically building a framework of how to think for your brain, building a thinking framework. Anyways, we do this interview, and I was nervous at the beginning, but we got into it. I loosened up a little bit, and Hunter, you know, as usual, he can just go. You just turn on the microphone and he just keeps going. So a lot of good stuff. Just hang in there and just know that there's stuff in here that you need to know, especially related to how we think and why we disagree. And we talk a little bit about the relationship between science and faith, and just like why there seems to be all this division, liberals and conservatives, or Democrats and Republicans, or fundamentalists and people who think they aren't fundamentalists, and science and faith. So anyways, great conversation, great dialogue, and really enjoyed it. So here's the interview. Hope you enjoy this. Yeah, tell me what you think. I'm good to go.
Ready to, already recording.
Awesome. Hello, Hunter. Thank you so much for doing this. Like, I feel I'm very, very excited to be talking to you right now. And just welcome to this thing.
Well, thanks for having me at this thing. And I mean, you know, that's what's great about the internet, is that people who are having particular shared experiences in this very interesting time in which we live can find each other regardless of geography, and we can compare notes and find ways to work together to help solve problems.
Yeah, and so the coolest part about all of this was the whole podcast medium and finding you guys. I had an hour and a half commute both ways to and from work for like a year. And I think this was maybe two years ago, maybe a year and a half ago. But I came across what was then the Brian Callen Show, and I felt like I felt like I was there as things were evolving. That's what added to the whole experience, was I felt like the conversation started evolving in a particular direction, and I could not contain these podcasts. Like, I would listen to these podcasts and immediately come home and like have to talk to my wife about all of these. I think we're figuring out, like, there's all this new science. We're figuring this stuff out. Like, this is why we argued in college with our friends about this. And like, this is why, you know, and it just was so crazy. So anyways, I'm a long, long time fan of the show. I feel like I've heard like days worth of audio of you and Brian talking. So this is crazy. It's just so cool to be able to talk to you. Why don't you just, for the people, for like the three people who don't know who you are, where are you from originally?
Yeah, well, I think there's probably a lot more than three people who have no idea who I am. But I my My mom is from Kansas City. My dad grew up in Arnhem in the south of the Netherlands of Holland. And my dad worked for Citibank. And so we grew up all over the I grew up traveling all over the world. I was born in Saudi Arabia, lived in Brazil, lived in Greece, lived in England, you know, just all over the place. And then Brian Callen, stand-up comedian extraordinaire, you know, famous for his role on Pool Boy as Pool Boy on Mad TV, was his dad was my dad's boss. So the first house that I went to after being born was the Callen household. Wow. So Brian and I have literally known each other our entire lives. And, you know, just because Brian was buddies with Joe, sort of, you know, got into this whole podcasting thing. He had a podcast. And then Brian and I would talk about books and, like, you know, L.A. Brian has a friend, Dove Davidoff, a stand-up comedian, who has this great thing about being in L.A. And he's like, moving to L.A. is like swimming with dolphins. Like, you get in and you're like, there are all these beautiful, magical creatures around me. It's so amazing. And then, you know, and then after about half an hour, you're like, I'm wet and cold and bored. I just want a book. Somebody please throw me a book. So Brian and I would sit around and we'd read all these books and we'd talk about all these books. And I was like, you know, Brian, you're like kind of famous. Like, your podcast, without you even really trying, gets all these downloads. Why don't we get some of these academics on? And he was like, wait a minute, you think these like scientists and authors would want to talk? I'm like, probably. Like, yeah. I don't think anybody like really reads their books or talks about their books.
Yeah, or invites them on an interview or anything like that, right? Like, they're not getting a whole lot of press for these books sometimes.
So our whole thing was like, we want to talk to them. We have download numbers. Why not just have them on and we'll expose people to these ideas who probably wouldn't get exposed to them? And it was like, I mean, the amazing thing about this show is that I think for the first 3-4 years, we were just so focused on having interesting conversations and just figuring things out that we didn't even realize that anybody was listening. I mean, like, you see the download numbers and it's this very hypothetical thing. Like, there are statistics that say people are listening. But then the last year has really been like actually connecting with the people out there and being like, oh, there are some like really interesting people that listen to this thing. And oh, they really appreciate that we don't pretend to know everything.
Yeah. And it's what I really appreciate is this weird combination that you and Brian are, because you are not foreign to the academic world, but you're also not foreign to Brian's world. I mean, I think when you went to California, I mean, you started getting into the acting scene, and that's what kind of caused this kintsugi, I guess is the phrase, like caused this like disconnection between what you had learned in the academic world and then what you're experiencing among, you know, the more free-spirited people that you're experiencing in acting school and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, can I use the F-bomb on this podcast?
Go for it.
So what I've been fond of saying in the last couple of weeks is that Brian and I have been trying to unfuck ourselves, and that we both got fucked up in complementary ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, Brian as a kid, you know, didn't feel like he was particularly smart or academic. And so he focused on sports and comedy and, you know, being entertaining and funny. And I, on the other hand, was like, I live in the world of books and ideas and the brain and all of that sort of stuff. And I don't feel comfortable around sports or anything like that. And so it really has been this sort of big undoing project as we sort of, you know, tried to like shake each other and help each other realize, no, this thing you don't think you can do, and like just sort of rubbing off on each other and sort of picking up different things from each other. And I mean, really what it comes down to is there's this great Marshall McLuhan quote which says, anyone who thinks there's a distinction between education and entertainment doesn't understand the first thing about either. And
man, I love that.
That's the reality is, and this is sort of, you know, with everything, you know, because I co-wrote The Straight A Conspiracy with Katie O'Brien, and like that was also so much of it was that we were like, the reality is that if you look at most history textbooks and you like put it in front of you know, somebody in the entertainment industry or somebody who was in charge of marketing, and you were like, okay, how many eyeballs do you think this textbook would get in the like free market? And they'd be like, zero.
Yeah.
Like, no one would read this thing. And it's just not entertaining. And that's not how any of these things need to be. I mean, Dan Carlin has done, you know, such a good job of making so much entertaining. And so that's really, you know, where the Mixed Mental Arts Project is now evolving to. And the exciting thing is that, like, if you go and watch Brian's stand-up today, you're like, wait a minute, these are all ideas from Mixed Mental Arts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know that he's, yeah. So, I mean, so that's really sort of where this thing is going now.
So where do you start? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, when I try to explain to people what it is that I'm getting out of these podcasts and then what the idea of Mixed Mental Arts, I never know, where do you start? Do you start with intuition versus rationale? Like I never know where I always end up just vomiting a ton of author names, a ton of books, and a ton of and like I just vomit it all together, and I never really know where. How do you start when someone's like what is it that you guys are trying to do?
Well, I think, you know, that's what I've done for the last 300 episodes, is just vomit a ton of author names.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you get exposed to these ideas and you're like, these are so powerful.
Yes.
Everyone needs to know these. And then the challenge is, yeah, how do you communicate them in a way that is accessible and that people can get them and doesn't require them to read 150 books? Mm-hmm. Like, ultimately, we want people to read those books and we want them to have that experience. But, you know, that's sort of something that we've been struggling with for the last year in particular. And, you know, what we've really sort of come down to is, how do we make smart convenient? Hmm. And that's really our goal, is that, you know, people are busy. They, you know, they have to like pay their bills. They have kids to take care of. Maybe they have aging parents, whatever it may be. And Brian and I have had the luxury and the opportunity to go and read all these books and interview all these authors, but not everybody is going to have that opportunity. And so now what we're really focusing on is, okay, we read all these books, we interviewed all these authors, what conclusions can we draw? And so that's why we're doing the Mixed Mental Arts Belt System, which is basically going to be these 9 core ideas that we think that everybody needs in the 21st century in order to, you know, navigate the world and just handle this time of humanity's first family dinner.
So where do you, I mean, do you start with the brain? Because for me, the idea that really hooked me, and it obviously it came from this place that I felt very personally. You know, in college we'd have all of these, you know, very philosophically minded friends, and you know, we just really enjoyed talking about ideas and presumably trying to be rational. And I remember some of our friends really enjoyed any time someone said, "I feel like," like a friend would just come, just like barreling in, just like heretic, do not say "I feel like," you think, you know, and people are so proud of that distinction. And it always bothered me on a weird level. Like I didn't know why. I couldn't explain why, because there was something very, there was something that I did experience that felt like feeling when I was thinking. And so then when, you know, hearing you guys talk about that our brains aren't as rational as we would like to imagine was really like, man, that roped me in. And from then on, like everything else kind of was dominoes for me. Do you guys start at the brain, or like, or maybe you can just talk about that idea?
Yeah, I could. I mean, well, so firstly, the idea that thinking and feeling are always linked, that's the green belt.
Okay.
So, you know, you're just, I mean, the fact that, you know, you got the green belt right off the bat,
It's so impressive. What's the white belt?
So the white belt is just, you know, asking people, what is your culture?
Right? Okay, gotcha.
So, you know, everybody has a culture, but the nature of culture is because of this thing that, you know, John Haidt calls naive realism, what the Buddhists called Maya, that, you know, we download this culture from our environment, from our parents, from the people around us. And then at a certain point, it just makes so much sense to us. And that's how we see the world. And then anybody who sees the world different comes off as like crazy or nuts or biased by their ideology, or there's something wrong with them. And so the first step is just realizing, yes, you have a culture. And if you can see how powerfully culture shapes the choices and the thoughts of all the other humans on the planet, well, then guess what? It does the same thing for you.
Yeah. And it makes you a lot more empathetic towards other. You're not like, I can't believe someone would do that. You're a little bit more empathetic towards it.
Well, and you're a little bit more humble, which is a lot of what we're trying to create. And so, you know, the yellow belt is culture binds and blinds. And so culture, you know, helps bind people into groups, but it also creates blind spots and it blinds them to other ways of seeing the world. And every culture has its blind spots. And the problem is that those blind spots mess us up in ways that we don't even realize because we're just so blind to them. And especially if we're just surrounded in an echo chamber of people who think the same way that we do. So that's the yellow belt. And then the orange belt is the tribe or Dunbar number. So basically every animal on the planet has a natural group size. And Robin Dunbar figured out that the natural group size for humans is about 150 relationships. So, you know, we all had this very exciting experience when we first got on Facebook where it was like, I can have 10,000 friends. This is so cool. And then, you know, the reality of our sort of neurological limits hit. And, you know, in a few years, there are people floating up on your Facebook feed.
Like, who is this?
Who is this? And I'm friends with them? Yeah. That's so fascinating.
Yeah. What's more creepy now is when it gives you the memories now. And it's like, hey, you guys became friends 5 years ago. Here's a picture of you two. And you're like, I don't know when I was at this place with this person.
So, and that the reality is that, you know, that means that most people are strangers to us. And, you know, we have to stereotype in order to make sense of people. And I think you mentioned when we chatted briefly on Twitter that you're Catholic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's get into things that were very uncomfortable for me to confront. Which is that Jesus had figured out a lot of this stuff 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, if you take the story of the Good Samaritan, you know, so you've got this lawyer comes along who wants to justify himself and wants to basically rationalize his prejudices and show how smart he is and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, he says, Jesus, what is the law? And Jesus says, well, how do you understand it, right? Mm. He's not even like telling him what he thinks because he knows that if whatever he says, this guy is going to like try and trap him and trick him.
Yeah.
And so he gets the guy and the guy says, love thy neighbor as thyself. And then he's like, well, go and do that then, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the guy says, but who is my neighbor? And then he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. And it's a story that's perfectly designed to violate someone's stereotypes. Yeah. Like Jesus is dealing with the Dunbar number because he's bringing into conflict what you believe about the Samaritans, who were supposedly the nemesis of Judeans everywhere. And, you know, just showing that if the person behaves better and happens to be a Samaritan, then what matters is the behavior. Mm. And what Jesus is doing, what we would now call is creating deliberate cognitive dissonance for the lawyer. And he's basically, you know, essentially triggering the lawyer so that the lawyer has to become aware of his feelings and then has to confront and reflect on those feelings. And that's where we get into the green belt. And the green belt is that thinking and feeling are always linked. So,
real quick. So, is the dissonance oftentimes is when someone has two competing values or two competing like mm-hmm. intuitive, like either the value of sacredness and the value of, I don't know, being kind to your neighbor or the value of the purity, I guess, maybe of the Samaritans, but then this other intuitive feeling of I need to love all of my neighbors. Is that kind of what's happening?
Well, he's bringing into conflict basically the lawyer's tribal feelings about we're the good guys, the Samaritans are jerks.
Yeah.
With like the stated principles of the lawyer's own most cherished beliefs mm-hmm. that come from the Torah or the Talmud or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And that he has to, it's basically, you know, you have to reflect on, you know, what matters more, your petty tribalism or your principles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that's in general, I mean, that was in terms of the conflict that was created for me, a lot of it came down to reading, it was a lot of scientific books, but you know, the one that really laid me low was John Hyde's Happiness Hypothesis.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for somebody sort of coming from, And I think it's important to distinguish between science as a method for testing your beliefs and then science as tribe. But, you know, someone coming from the tribe of science who's like, we're the good guys. We figured it all out. Like, everything before us was worthless. We're amazing. You know, the whole because science crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To read something like John Haidt's happiness hypothesis and then be like, wait a minute. It feels like this guy who's like way deeper into science than I am. Like, he's way smarter than I am. And it really seems like he's saying we reinvented the wheel. And that a lot of these things, you know, were just not expressed in a form that we could understand or appreciate. So, you know, Jesus says, you know, you see the splinter in your brother's eye, but you don't see the log in your own, right? And, you know, if you just sort of look at that quickly and you're like, whatever, this is some cute saying from some guy who lived 2,000 years ago, then you dismiss it. But then when you look at what all the science is saying, and, you know, the terminology is different. We say my side bias, and you see how people behave that. And then you're like, oh, man. And then you start looking around. You start looking at the behavior of the people around you, and you start looking at your own behavior. And then you start to realize that, yes, Jesus was right.
Yeah, it's almost I like the distinction between science as a method and, like, scientism or science as almost like as a religion almost. And how, like, because that phrase was not packaged in a scientific way, that someone who is very biased towards science would look at it and go, this isn't a scientific statement, so I'm going to discredit it. Whereas someone a little more open to allegory or open to the deeper meaning behind it. And I think that, man, that's one of the – so basically what you guys are trying to do is you're taking a lot of this well, I guess it's not – I mean, it's not – modern in the sense like cutting edge, like it just, this is brain science that just happened 2 weeks ago. This is stuff that was from like the 1970s, I think you said, but it hasn't diffused, and people aren't taking brain science and social science and psychology and all of these things and trying to make a worldview or a tool for walking through the world from all of these different things. Like, one of the stories that you tell a lot that I really love is talking with David Sloan Wilson about you know, he's trying to diffuse ideas, and then you asked him if he had read the book, The Diffusion of Innovation, and he was like, oh, no, I never read that book, right? And that like these we get very specific instead of being more generalists and kind of picking and choosing from all the best categories and trying to just slam the books together and make it all fit into a worldview.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I had a conversation with we did a podcast yesterday with David Sloan Wilson. And then, you know, I've been talking with him a bunch, and, you know, a lot of what, you know, how our thinking has evolved in the last few years is he talks about parallel universes. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who are talking about the same thing, but because we get hung up on terminology or symbols or tribal affiliation, we don't realize that we're talking about the same thing. And, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, Jesus of Nazareth, or you're talking about the Buddha, or you're talking about, you know, Muhammad or the Hindus, or you're talking about some neuroscientist in a lab in San Diego, we're all trying to make sense of the same experience, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Humanity has always been trying to figure out this thing called reality. How do you build a society? How do we interact with each other? All of that. And, you know, if you're really going to practice science as a method, then you have to be able to make sense of what all these people are doing, what they've been talking about, and not get hung up on petty terminology and tribalism, and really smash those books together. And in practice, part of it is that, you know, when you smash the things together, it actually becomes easier to figure things out, because so much of how the human brain works and a lot of what Big Mike Bryan's dad talks about is pattern recognition. And you can't recognize a pattern when you only have one dot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, if you're just staring at your culture and the way your culture says it, it's actually very hard to make sense of it. It's having to, like, look at, oh, you know, okay, so you got Jesus who's telling the story about the Good Samaritan. And then you've got this thing called the Dunbar number. And then you've got this phenomenon called stereotyping. And then you got this whole other thing where Shakespeare talks about, you know, in Hamlet, that there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And so you got these four different pieces that are from all these different disciplines, and yet, you know, they're all talking about the same thing. And then it's as you have all of these things noodling around in your head that you then start to like figure out that they're, even though they seem like four separate dots, that they're actually connected and that they're talking about the same thing, but in different ways. And that all of them can play a role in illuminating a better playbook and a better worldview to help us all navigate it. And that's the real opportunity of the internet in the 21st century is that, you know, we can have, you know, people coming from lots of different perspectives, lots of different cultures. And that as we hash our differences out, that we will evolve more and more wisdom and better tools for helping us navigate this environment.
Yeah, and one of the things that really I resonate with a lot is this idea of fundamentalism on both camps, sometimes we have faith and reason or faith in science or religion and science put on opposite extremes, right? And really sometimes what it comes down to is how comfortable you are with doubt or with wandering into a new territory. It's literally like being comfortable with international travel. Like, have you ever been to another country where you had to just be okay not understanding a lot of things and that you might, you know, you make a decision and you might be wrong or, you know, you're trying to operate in that. And on both sides, the religious or the science side can sometimes wander into, or at least be accused of this type of fundamentalism. And that's something you talk about, right? Maybe you could just describe what you mean by fundamentalism, because I think maybe some people from the Catholic worldview are thinking something different if they're listening to this.
Yeah. I was born in Saudi. My parents have spent a lot of their time in the Middle East, and you know, there's a Sufi scholar, that I know. And he said he spends all of his time dealing with Islamic fundamentalists, or not all of his time, but a large amount of it, and sort of, you know, helping talk to these, you know, young, angry men and helping to try and de-radicalize them. And he had this great line that he said, which was that it takes 5 seconds to become a fundamentalist and a lifetime to become a Muslim. Mm. And, you know, it reminded me a lot of my own 20s. And, you know, it reminded me a lot of Atul Gawande has this great speech he gave at Caltech about, you know, what it means to be a scientist. And he talks about how, you know, when he first went away to college, you know, his mind was blown. He was exposed to these new ideas. It was so exciting. And then the first thing he did with that knowledge was to go home and tell everybody back home how they were all wrong. And it was his job to correct the faults in their thinking.
Gosh.
And he's like, and I'm sure they really love that.
Yeah. Same experience, man. Like, so I went to a very Catholic university, and it was a very similar experience, because you feel like suddenly you're finding new truth that you hadn't realized before. And so then when you come back home, you feel like you're this messiah figure that has come to like correct everyone's like all of your home priest's liturgical wrongs. You're just like, you're doing the mass wrong. Yeah. I know you've been in seminary for 20 years, but I've been at Catholic university for two. So like, you know, just
for literally minutes, I've been studying this thing. And now and then, you know, he says, and over time you come to realize that the scientific mind is an experimental one, not a litigious one. Mm. And, you know, that very much was my own journey. And, you know, the more I thought about this, the more, and, you know, just sort of reading people like John Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, is about sort of that very self-righteous state.
Yeah.
And what you realize, you know, when you move around between enough different tribes is that, you know, fundamentalism is a psychology, it's not an ideology, right? Mm-hmm. So you can think about those dyed in the wool, like, you know, Bolshevik extremists, or, you know, the people under Pol Pot, or, you know, the Nazis, or, you know, certain new atheist figures, right? Yeah, yeah. Like, there are plenty of people in lots of tribes around the world, or certain social justice warriors, who are just so convinced of the rightness of their cause, and that they are the good guys, and these other people are the bad guys, and have this sense that, like, we're part of this grand historical mission. And that if only everybody thought like us, that all the world's problems would be solved.
Yeah, and if only, and a lot of times it's if only people would think rationally the way we are thinking rationally. You know, like if only people would take, if Alex Jones could just sit down with you and take you from point one to point two to point three, like you would think the same way, and you're crazy to not, like you're just being emotional and irrational to not agree to these points.
Yeah, and crucially, that's a very particularly Western version of what fundamentalism looks like, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're trying to, like, what these figures do is they spread fear in the name of righteousness. And if you think about, you know, say Joseph McCarthy or someone like that, you know, Joseph McCarthy is justifying his behavior much that like that young lawyer. And he justifies it in terms of America, right? Because America is good. And so he wraps himself in the flag. And it's very much the same thing, you know, in the Salem witch trials, right? They justify their behavior in terms of, you know, Christianity. You know, ISIS justifies it in terms of Islam, right? Islam is the answer. That's what all the fundamentalists say. And then, you know, in the West, if you're a figure who believes in the Enlightenment and sort of these secular values, then what you wrap yourself is in reason,
yeah.
Right? We are practicing reason, and you need to be reason, you know, practice reason. And the reality is that the real thing that undermines all of that is that Greenbelt idea of thinking and feeling are always linked, which is Descartes' error.
Yeah, so talk about that for a second, because that, I think that's going to be foreign to a lot of people. And I'm trying, you know, I've been trying to assimilate the classical understanding of, you know, the human person as intellect and will, with this idea of the intuition. So just talk a little bit, because from the Christian worldview, you know, Aquinas and all these, which inherited a lot of philosophy and stuff from the Greeks and all this classical philosophy, but then trying to reconcile that with this like experiential, well, I mean, a scientific advancement in our understanding of how our brains actually work, not just theoretically. And it reminds me a lot of, maybe you could touch on this too, like the difference in an economist's worldview of how the world works, mm-hmm. and someone like Jonathan Haidt or someone like Kahneman, yeah, Thinking Fast and Slow, right? Daniel Kahneman.
Yep. So yeah, so I think the first thing to realize is that, you know, words are labels that we come up with, and, you know, everybody's had this experience on the internet where you're using a word one way and then somebody else has a totally different definition of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Like I'm talking about capitalism, you're talking about capitalism, but we get a little bit into the conversation and it's clear that your understanding of capitalism and my understanding of capitalism are not the same.
Yeah, a horrible experience. My freshman year of college, we're sitting around the dinner table and this girl was talking about how she thought that she actually was a communist. And then when we were like, what makes you think that? And she's like, well, I just feel like we should just share more of our stuff with people. I was like, I do not think that means what you think it means. Like, I don't even think I understand what communism means, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't mean that. Like, I'm pretty sure it doesn't mean just share stuff with people.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, it's this reason is one of those words that means totally different things to different people. And, you know, I think that, you know, let's look at some Enlightenment figures, like, say, Ben Franklin, right? And how Ben Franklin used words like reason. Mm-hmm. So Ben Franklin, there's a great story, John Haidt tells it in The Happiness Hypothesis from Ben Franklin's autobiography, where he talks about being on this ship and, you know, he's headed over to England. And at this point, Ben Franklin is a vegetarian. He has his moral principles. You know, he believes that, you know, he shouldn't, you know, take part in the killing or the taking of other life. And so, you know, but on the other side of the ship, there are a bunch of his fellow passengers who are catching cod. And they're preparing cod in the way that New England way that he remembers from his childhood. And it just smells so good. And so, you know, he says to himself, no, I can't. I'm a vegetarian. I have my principles. I'm not going over there. But it continues to smell so good. And so he wanders over just to, you know, I mean, we've all done this, right? You wander over just to see what's going on in the dessert case, right?
Like, yeah.
So we're just going to have a quick shifty. So he wanders over, and then he notices that as they're opening up the belly of these cod, that there are all these little fish inside the cod. And so then he says, well, these cod are murdering all these tiny little fish. And if I want to preserve life, then I should eat the big fish in order to protect the little fish.
Yeah.
And he says, it's an awfully convenient thing to be a reasonable creature because one can convince oneself of whatever one has a mind to do.
Yeah.
So Ben Franklin believes in reason, but he certainly doesn't believe that the human capacity for reason is somehow divorced from emotion or feeling.
Yeah.
He understands that they're inextricably linked. And so I think that, you know, a lot of the Enlightenment figures probably meant by reason is today what we would talk about being reasonable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's different from rationalizing, where you're able to give reasons for why you feel the way that you feel. And those reasons can be endlessly complicated. And a lot of people, the fundamentalist figures who run around talking about reason, they're actually the most unreasonable people. But they just endlessly rationalize their basic prejudices.
So how would you advise someone if they're just hearing this for the first time? It's like you're basically telling someone that they can't with certainty say that they're being rational at any point in time. So how do they what do they make of that data? Like how do they move forward, or how do they make sure that they are being reasonable in some, you know, what's the right relationship with your emotions? How do you make decisions?
It fundamentally changes the question you should ask yourself, mm-hmm. right? So it moves the question from am I being emotional to how am I being emotional?
Mm-hmm.
The question is not whether your thinking is being shaped by your feelings. It's what feelings are shaping your thinking.
Okay.
And so, you know, John Haidt has this great metaphor that comes off. So you mentioned Daniel Kahneman. Daniel Kahneman, this is back, Kahneman and Tversky are back in the 70s. And, you know, economists have this idea, you know, or this idea came into economics. It's actually not what Adam Smith believed, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So Adam Smith is often, you know, regarded as the founding father of capitalism. And, you know, he wrote two books, The Wealth of Nations, and then this book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And, you know, Russ Roberts has this great book called How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. And it's all about him as an economist, you know, finally reading Adam Smith's other book. And he says, you know, most economists haven't read this book and they should.
Or they don't even know it exists, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you read it, you get a very, very different picture of what Adam Smith thought, right? It would be like, if you only read Leviticus and thought you understood what the Bible was about,
yeah,
right?
Geez, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so when you read The Theory of Moral Sentiments, you know, the picture that emerges of, you know, Adam Smith says things like, you know, wealth just isn't going to make you that happy, like, you know, past your certain material needs, like, and you're like, really? This is the founder of capitalism said that? And, you know, the opening line of the book is about humans being altruistic, and you're like, really? Mm. So the picture that Smith has of human nature is nuanced, complex, it recognizes that we have all these conflicting impulses, and self-interest is what emerges from sort of us thinking through all those different perspectives until we've figured out what really serves our self-interest. But Roberts has a great example in there where of Jean Valjean from Les Miserables, where, you know, Jean Valjean's material self-interest is to lie and let somebody else go to jail for him for stealing that loaf of bread. But his psychological self-interest is to be able to live with himself and to live with, you know, the knowledge of God, right?
Yeah.
And so he turns himself in because he decides that that's what he needs. Mm. So, you know, our self-interest is actually, in the eyes of Adam Smith, is this quite complicated thing. But, you know, economists, that doesn't make for good math. And, you know, you need a tidy set of assumptions. And so what emerges is this caricature of humanity called Homo economicus, where just because it's tidy and an easier way to think about this, we reduce everything down to self-interest and down to human beings as this rational creature which is sometimes called Homo economicus. And Kahneman and Tversky in the 1970s, they were Israeli psychologists, and they were just finding out all the ways in which that wasn't true. We have all these weird cognitive biases, and you know, that those ideas then ended up, you know, creating this whole new school of economics called behavioral economics. And, you know, ultimately what it means is, and this is the really unpleasant thing, is that it means that a lot of the work that has been done is bad and will need to be thrown out. But that's not something that academics are going to want to do, because that's your job and that's your livelihood and that's what you built your career on.
And and Kahneman was, I think, one of the ideas that's really sticky is this idea that the classical understanding of the charioteer and the chariot, or the horses, I guess, like that the reasonable, our rational nature is driving the rest of our emotions and can be in charge of the rest of our emotions. But then this other idea that I think it's Kahneman comes up with, or I've just heard often, is this idea of the rider and the elephant, that in fact, like, the rider sitting at the top of an elephant has way less control than like a Roman charioteer over the emotions and the passions and all those things, and that they're always at play.
Yep. And so that the rider and elephant metaphor comes from John Haidt, but it's Haidt summing up Kahneman's work
in a much stickier, contagious way, I guess.
Yeah, it's amazing. When Haidt really wants to move all of this science, he turns it into a simple story.
Yeah.
A lot like Jesus.
Haidt is Jesus reincarnated, I think.
Well, we do call, you know, we lovingly in Mixed Metal Arts, we talk about the Holy Trinity of Cultural Evolution, which is John Haidt, David Sloan Wilson, and Joe Henrich.
Yeah.
And there's a scientific New Testament out there, which is these four Gospels, which is the four books that they wrote.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, just a packaging marketing thing to help move these ideas. But and give people a toehold into, if you're going to read something, read those four books.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the point is that there, in general, the more and more you look across the science, the more you realize there is a lot of reinventing the wheel. And even the diffusion of innovations, which you talked about earlier, you know, I read the diffusion of innovations. It's, you know, 600 pages or something. And, you know, the more you noodle over what it's really saying and you're really thinking about it, you're like, it kind of sounds like missionary work. Like, it sounds like you're saying that ideas move through missionary work. I kind of feel like this also was already figured out.
Yeah. Well, it just wasn't packaged in a scientific 600-page tome. You know, that's the official way to get an idea like that out there.
But the irony is that, you know, I mean, the diffusion of innovations is an idea that didn't diffuse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I love that. I think that's hilarious. So,
yeah.
And that's
because, you know, the problem is that the scientific style of writing is actually unscientific.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't respond to the evidence of what we know about how ideas actually move.
And so, but so many places I want to go, but you're a tutor. You tutor still as well? Like, you tutor kids?
That's my day job.
Yeah, that's awesome. So because you've had your hand constantly in teaching, I feel like you see that very immediately, like all the time, that you know, when you're, I feel like teachers see that, teachers know this innately, but then there's still, among teachers, when you talk to teachers, like, there's we hold up these people that write these huge research papers and all of these very tech, it's just so weird that we can, on the one hand, really value great and amazing teachers or communicators, but on the other hand, have this whole world of people that look down on a more popular style, right? Like, this happens in the Catholic world. You know, you have the real philosophers, the scholarly philosophers or theologians, but then you have these books that kind of package it in an easier to understand. You know, we have a Scott Hahn, who's a brilliant, brilliant man, but he's a very famous author. And, you know, some people like poo-poo on him because they're like, oh, you're dumbing down it all. It's not written as technical. It doesn't have as much nuance and all this stuff. I find that so, so interesting, because I'm often, you know, having a foot in both worlds, like trying to teach, but also trying to, like, navigate through that world and that, and those weird, again, like, emotions about all of those different things.
Well, and I mean, you know, I think it's in all cases, it's a dysfunctional system.
Yeah.
because, you know, I mean, we're rather than us working together and trying to solve the problem together, it just becomes, you know, this territoriality, and it's massively self-defeating. And, you know, I think a much better way to think about this, you know, David Sloan Wilson talks about the science to narrative chain, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's okay, great. So let's imagine that you've got someone like David, and, you know, he's gone out and he's figured out all this stuff about evolution. And then, you know, but that's the problem that he's been focused on, and he's gotten really, really good at it. Meanwhile, you have Brian Callen, right? Brian Callen has spent all of his time trying to figure out how to entertain people, how to grab their attention, how to make it really relatable and really connect to people's lives, because that's what great comedy does. And, you know, my job is to really just bridge that and, you know, be there and help, you know, the two of them have a productive conversation, so that all of David's great work can then really diffuse and really move through things like comedy. But there's, you know, this is an old, old pattern of, like, you know, the scholar thinking that they're better than the popularizer, and then the popularizer thinking that the scholar is out of touch. Mm. And, you know, you find that again and again. I mean, you know, think about, you know, I mean, yeah, it's happened in every, and I think this is why words like religion are so problematic. It's happened in every belief system, mm-hmm. whether it's science or, you know, Christianity or Islam or whatever it may be. There's always been the dusty scholar who thinks that he's superior. You know, there's a great story. So, Zhuangzi, who's the second big figure in Taoism, has a story where, you know, all the big scholars, they come to Zhuangzi and they say, Zhuangzi, you're so smart. Like, you know, you should come work with us in the palace, in the ivory tower. And he says, you know, I've heard that inside the imperial palace, there is a turtle that is 1,000 years old, and it's dead, and it's been wrapped and preserved in silk. And, you know, this is the people in the imperial city are like, oh, yes, this great turtle. It's a great relic, and blah, 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 blah. And Zhuangzi says, you know, do you think that the turtle would rather be dead, wrapped in silk, and 1,000 years old, or alive and in the mud? And they say, probably alive and in the mud. And he goes, Zhuangzi feels the same way as the turtle. And so then he doesn't take the job. And I think that's, it's not a healthy system. Hmm. And, you know, and this is a pattern that is just one of those patterns that recurs again and again. The other story like that I love is from Gulliver's Travels, and the story of the Laputans and the Bound the Barbie.
Yeah. I remember this.
And so, you know, there's, and when Jonathan Swift wrote this in the 1700s, he was already parodying the Royal Academy.
Yeah. It was a situation that everyone reading it would have known 100% that he's making fun of these philosopher kings who have tattered clothes and can't pay their own bills, but they're holding up philosophy and smarts and academics higher than like practical knowledge.
Yeah, and I think it's massively unhealthy. I mean, the divorce of theory from practice, like, it doesn't help anyone. I mean, you have, you know, the pure theoreticians who can't do anything practical and can't do anything that. And then, you know, one of the things that always stuck with me was Nikola Tesla talking about Thomas Edison. Hmm. And that, you know, Thomas Edison was so obsessed with being practical that he did everything in the most ineffective way. Huh. And that if he used even a little bit of theory, that, you know, he would have been so much more effective. And, you know, it's like all of these things. You need both. And, you know, it takes wisdom to know the difference as to when you should use each one. But, like, you know, people become obsessed with one thing or the other, and then, you know, you just develop a myopia, and that becomes problematic.
So what would you give, if someone listening, what practically can someone do to avoid maybe this, maybe call it this more fundamentalist thinking, or like this trap of getting really, really, myopic about a way of thinking. Like I always feel like it's hard to pinpoint something practical other than just arguing and yelling at this person. like it's hard to, I don't know. I often feel like I'm attracted to the friends who are more open-minded and can do this, but I often don't know how to, because you start pushing on how someone's thinking and the cultural baggage that they might have, or the cultural situation that they have inherited, and it gets really uncomfortable for them, right? Or mm-hmm. just like the conversation in general gets uncomfortable. So how do you bridge that? You know, people are going home for Christmas and stuff. How do you bridge that with like start that conversation? Do you just start telling all the stories from all the books, or like?
I think the most important thing to understand, you know, I mean, you've talked about values like sacredness, and you know, there we all have these different moral intuitions, but the core intuition that is the same in all groups is fairness. Mm. You can say anything as long as you're fair. And so, you know, I mean, this is why South Park gets away with so much, is because they make fun of everyone and they make fun of themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the most important thing is, you know, and this is something that, you know, I've sort of evolved from working with kids, right? Like, I inevitably am telling kids many things that they don't want to confront, you know, that they have been responsible all along for their academic performance, mm-hmm. that it's their behaviors, their attitudes, all of these things need to change. And these are the last things that any teenager wants to hear,
yeah.
right? So how do you tell those things in a way that a teenager can hear? Well, firstly, you make fun of yourself, mm-hmm. right? Like, you make fun of yourself all the time. And so that you don't feel threatening, you're not saying that you're any better than them, you're reducing any sense of a power dynamic, and if anything, you're humbling yourself and making yourself lower than them. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is to just talk about your own failings. And that opens up the possibility for the other person to reflect and to be able to confront these things. And then, you know, in reality, I think the other thing, too, is that much of this comes down to counterinsurgency. So when you're working with a kid, you're working with the kid, but you're really working with the whole family,
yeah.
and the whole community and the whole environment, so that ultimately everyone is being bathed in these ideas and getting these things. And so the question is always, like, who is the crazy person, right?
Yeah.
And if when I come into a house, I'm the crazy person, right? Like, they're like, oh, you're saying, like, I can do anything if I put my mind to it. Oh, you're saying that if I actually tried and, like, analyze my mistakes, I do better. And they're like, whatever, like, I heard that. And then, you know, and then what you have to do is you start winning everybody over, mm-hmm. and you start, you know, getting people to open up and share their stories and start changing some behaviors until ultimately the kid is the crazy person. Mm. And it's like, duh, of course this has been your issue all along. Of course you need to analyze your mistakes. Of course you need to read the book before you write the essay. And then, you know, then that social pressure is what helps flip people. So I think part of it is also being realistic about, you know, who is going to be the effective change agent in that person's life. Mm. Because, you know, like, realistically, like, you know, it's like, the advantage that I have over parents is that I'm a total stranger.
Yeah.
I'm not your parents, you're not worried about, do you love me? Like, none of those questions are involved. Yeah. And, like, you know, doing these things with my own parents and trying to expose them to these ideas, like, I have to be much more circumspect and direct. And with my own dad, I'm just like, oh my God, we had this great conversation. This book is so great. I think you'd really enjoy this book. And then allowing him to hear it from other people, so that he reaches the conclusions on his own time and in his own way.
And the whole time being sure that you're not falling into the trap of thinking that it's purely reason, that you can just be reasonable with someone and that's the only motivator, right? Like, I think that's one of the big things I take away a lot from hearing your conversations is that I love the story of Don't Mess with Texas, and how they,
yeah.
instead of, you know, they could have just gone to everyone in Texas and did this national campaign of like, when you litter, it causes problems for our country or for our state. Well, the country state of Texas. but they, you know, instead they appeal to emotion, to this narrative, to try to move that idea instead of just trying to be purely rational from a model that like everyone's perfectly rational. If we're just give them rational arguments, then they will accept it.
Yeah, I mean, you're trying to win over the elephant, and the elephant has all sorts of needs, right? The elephant wants to feel heard. The elephant wants to feel safe. The elephant wants to feel understood. Like, very often there's some, you know, like, I mean, you know, and, you know, I mean, I think what's been exciting about the conversations and how they've been evolving with Brian is that increasingly we've been talking about our dads, because that is so much of it is that so much of this, like, you know, Brian, you know, is, you know, like he said this great thing where he was like, you know, he was like, I would quote, you know, all these libertarian thinkers and all that sort of stuff. And he was like, that's because I was defending my dad. Mm. Like, he'd gotten these ideas from his dad. And so, you know, all of those feelings were wrapped up. And, you know, it's a guy in the mixed mental arts community, Dave Colin. And he says, you know, the thing about racists is they're people who love their dad so much they can't admit their dad was wrong about anything.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah. I've met some people like that.
Yeah. And, yeah, you know, it's
it comes from a good place. It comes from a good place.
Yeah, I mean, you're just like, you have these strong feelings, and then, you know, you have to like learn to separate these things out. And I think that's the thing is that, you know, it's the I mean, what does it take to do this work? Well, you know, I think that playbook was pretty much figured out, you know, 2000 years ago. It requires humility. It requires turn taking. It requires, you know, little stories, and that very often the best way is actually not to directly challenge people. Like, you know, Jesus was, I'm sure, way smarter than this lawyer, right? Who he told the story of the Good Samaritan to. But Jesus doesn't do a full frontal assault on the lawyer, right? Yeah. He doesn't, like, you can't, someone who is litigious, you can't out-litigate. You can't.
Yeah.
Right? So what you have to do is you have to have that experimental mind and be playful. And just be like, oh, you know, what do you think the law says? Oh, you think it says that? Okay, so here, I'm going to tell you a story, and then you tell me what you think. Oh, okay, there you go. And then he's planted that seed, and then the lawyer goes away, and the lawyer does whatever. But it's not just for the lawyer. It's also that all these other people are standing around watching this experience. And it may be that ultimately it was, you know, that crowd that really got the story rather than the lawyer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all going to have to be, you know, there's a lot of uncomfortable conversations to be had. And, you know, we're all going to have to be super experimental, try things out, see yeah. what works, and then compare notes and just keep on evolving better tools and a better playbook for how to better have these conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. There's one last question that I want that I haven't heard you talk much of, but I'm always curious is, how do you think of, and especially after reading all these books, and how do you think of doubt? Because I feel intuitively that on both sides, if we're talking about science and religion, on both sides, I feel like what can oftentimes radicalize someone to be more fundamentalist, either a science perspective or a religion perspective, is this fear of doubt, the fear of I'm not certain. And so two stories. I mean, I gave a talk to a bunch of parents, and I was going, you know, answering some common objections that high schoolers have, and just kind of saying, here's like three common questions that high schoolers have. Here's some like arguments for, you know, answering these questions or whatever. And afterwards, this parent came up to me and was very unnerved by the whole, I mean, it was just like a 45-minute lecture on these three things. And her issue was she felt like I was casting doubt, that I was, by just raising the question, she felt like I was in some ways just poisoning Christianity for her. And she was like, I disagree with your approach entirely. And if this is what you're doing with my high schooler, I don't want them to be a part of it at all. And I was, and I was like, really, you know, this person was very emotionally upset about the idea of doubt. And I said, well, we don't, every time we talk to high schoolers, we don't just say, here are all these reasons you should doubt your faith. We just say, like, you know, every now and then we'll say, hey, this is a common question that comes up, and like, here's the answer for it. And she was like, no, you should just shouldn't talk about that at all. And when I asked her, like, well, what should we talk about? She's like, I think you should just talk about why we are so joyful as Christians, and everything, basically everything's great and happy. And then on the other side, I remember watching this video of Neil deGrasse Tyson. I think it's called like The Edge of the Unknown, or The Limit of Reason, or something like that. And he was going through systematically through all of these scientists from, you know, the Enlightenment or whatever, and who were, you know, also religiously minded people. And he would read about how they had all of this wonder about the world, and they would figure out things, and they would test things. But whenever they got to the limit of what they could know, whenever they got to like a problem they couldn't solve, they would suddenly, he would read a quote of them saying like, oh, how grand and wonderful is God. And he read that as giving up. Like he read that the way that they were handling maybe uncertainty or doubt or the edge of their knowledge, he read this like this kind of like Christian pronouncement of like, oh wow, you know, God is so wonderful and mysterious, as like just giving up and copping out. And so like on both sides, I feel like there's this uneasiness with how we handle doubt. And I know that scientists and Christians, especially fundamentalist Christians, compared to, I don't know, my experience as a Catholic, there are competing, I don't know, strategies to deal with doubt. But also, like, that just seems to be, for me, in my experience, the central issue. Like, how, are you comfortable with doubt? So I don't know. I just always wonder. I remember at one point tweeting, I think, Jonathan Haidt, and asking him, like, where does just objective truth and certainty and doubt fit into all of this? And but obviously on Twitter you can't like talk as, you know, like I was probably expecting a little too much from him. But I don't know, how do you think about that, or think about doubt, Hunter?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, I had a conversation yesterday with Sean McCoy, who has the Come to the Table podcast that he just started. Mm-hmm. And you know, Sean is somebody who came to Christianity later in life. And you know, one of the things that we talked about a lot is, you know, Isaac Newton believed that God had written two books, that one of them was the Bible and that the other one was the universe. Mm. And that in order to really, you know, begin to even sort of approximate understanding God, you had to read deeply in both. Mm. And a lot of what we talked about in terms of, you know, the divide and the forces of division between science and religion, you know, is that on both sides there's a lot of fear. Mm. And it's the fear to really read in one of those other books. Because what if you read and you find that it's not there? Mm. Like, what if you as a Christian, like, really look into the science and then you conclude that God doesn't exist? Or what if, you know, you are a scientist and you read closely in the Bible and you come to find that actually a lot of this ancient wisdom is stuff that was known 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and that we didn't actually, you know, we aren't so smart, and that, you know, we actually just got lost in arrogance. Mm. And that's scary, but it's also that's a weak faith, mm-hmm. on either part.
Yeah.
It's a weak faith in God, or it's a weak faith in the scientific principle. And, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, the old parable of the house that was built on sand versus the house that was built on rock. And there's a lot of people whose faith in either God or in the scientific method is built on sand. Yeah. And it's not really a sturdy faith. And if your faith in whatever it is that you believe in and however you navigate the world has been battle tested enough times, then you move from being afraid of these things to being curious.
Yeah.
Because you know that the closer you look, the more you will find and the more you will discover. And that that's the fun of the journey is being surprised by these new aspects of that investigation and that journey that you might not have realized.
Yeah, it's like the doubt. Yeah, the doubt makes everything else exciting and worth it. And that's how, I mean, for me, that's how I know that I'm going into an area where I'm going to learn something new or learn something that's that I didn't. I remember there was an interview where I think it was like Billy Graham's granddaughter or something. And they asked her, in all the years of Billy Graham's life, do you think Billy Graham ever doubted the existence of God? And she immediately, without a split second, was like, no, never. And I was like, bullshit. Like, just, I was like, no, I was like, no, like what a horrible representation of like Christianity. Yeah. That doubt makes the fact that I might be wrong makes my decision like I have some skin in the game, because if it was just so easy to be 100% certain about, I don't know, I feel like the doubt venturing off into those areas makes it all exciting and exhilarating. And it's hard for people to deal with that, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, well, and it's a deeply so part of how I, you know, sort of explain the whole fundamentalism thing too is that, listen, there are fundamentalists sell brain ice cream. Mm. That's what they do,
yeah.
Right? And there are 31 flavors of fundamentalism, but they all sell delicious confirmation bias, you know? And it's all, you know, you go, you listen to your favorite fundamentalist thinker, and, you know, they just endlessly tell you that you're right, we're the good guys, you know, we've got it all figured out. If only everybody thought like us, everything would be so great. And you're like, man, this is delicious. My brain loves this. And then, you know, what you and I, Edmund, Jonathan Haidt and all of these other people are selling a much less marketable product.
Vegetables.
We're selling vegetables, yeah, which is cognitive dissonance, you know, uncertainty, doubt, you know, and it's like, it really is like vegetables. And when you first taste it, you're like, this is gross. My brain does not like this. I never want this again.
Yeah.
These people are terrible. And, you know, I mean, my own sort of, road to Damascus moment, right? When the scale falls from your eyes, it is not pleasant.
No.
And, you know, when you move out of that sort of narrow certainty of thinking, of being litigious and thinking you have all the answers to like, man, I know nothing. It sucks. It's a terrible transitional moment. But the main thing is that it is a transitional moment. Like, you don't have to stay there. And it is when you move past that first 5 seconds of being a fundamentalist to that lifetime journey. And more you acquire a taste for broccoli. Mm. And you're like, actually, this is good for me. I like this. It's much more interesting. There's a lot more going on. And you seek those experiences out. So that, you know, you start to become really, you know, and ultimately you develop a distaste for the saccharine confirmation bias experience.
Well, I just to stretch the analogy to its limits, I think also you learn how to prepare vegetables. you learn how to do that, because I think more and more as the Facebook algorithms are just trying to surround us by things we're going to like, and the social media is surrounding us by stuff it already knows we're going to agree with and not hate. I think more and more it's going to become a virtue of the modern man to practice the habit of putting himself in places that he's not comfortable with or around people that he doesn't agree with. And I think that's such a necessary, I mean, I just like pray that my kids, you know, learn just that in and of itself of like, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I sit in a room full of people and we're complaining about I'm hearing people talk about the culture of death or this, like, you know, the world, you know, this world out there that's out to get us. And like talking about these people, talking about atheists and, or non-Christians and all these different people. And like, I just want to like stop the whole conversation and say like, you haven't talked to someone who's not just like you in both race, religion, and idea, like, in years. Like, you don't know anyone. Like, you don't know anyone that's a liberal. Like, you don't know.
Yep.
Yeah. So, or you don't know anyone that's Muslim or more, like, just, so anyways. Well,
yeah, no. And I think that's the thing is that absolutely. I think that, you know, like we're at that place where there is a real awareness of the problem of echo chambers, right?
Yeah.
And on the other side of being aware of the problem of echo chambers is that, yes, it does become, it's going to become distasteful to people that, like, you just hang out in your echo chamber. And then ultimately, when it's all about, like, a lot of this is about competing for status, right? And, you know, like the Billy Graham sort of approach where it's like, I never had a moment of doubt. I've always da da da, and I always knew it, and I can quote the Bible more than you, and all of that, right? And essentially, you know, Billy Graham was rewarded for that behavior. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's a group of people who sit around him, and they're like, wow, that's great. That's how a Christian should be, right? But it is this very superficial, like, media version of Christianity where you can cultivate this image of, like, it's, I mean, you know, Billy Graham is the, you know, sort of the Kim Kardashian airbrushed version of a Christian.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, we photoshopped this really a lot so that it looks like you never doubted, you know, you always have the perfect Bible passage, all that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah. So when I think Thérèse of Lisieux, who's like a very popular saint, like mystic and all this stuff, when her sisters, when they published her autobiography, her sisters edited out the parts where she was struggling with atheism because they wanted to airbrush it. And it was only years later that they added that back in. Or a similar story with Mother Teresa, right? Like, and wanting to remove the doubt because we can't let people think that doubt is okay, or that this is something that's common, when in fact everyone at some point, like, really has to, you know, go back home, close the door, go into their room and just go, is everything I'm saying true? Like, is this, do right. I actually believe this? Do I really believe this? You know?
And I think that's the point is that, you know, all these rumbles are already there. And, you know, you hear people like talking a lot about how they want authenticity. They want authenticity. They want authenticity. Mm-hmm. They have a problem with the superficial photoshopped, you know, billboard models, right? They have a problem with a lot of these sort of, inauthentic cardboard cutout people. So there's a hunger there already. And, you know, I mean, that's why, I mean, specifically, you know, increasingly, you know, I just have realized that most of my job is midwifing. And
that's
you know, I mean, well, and I mean, you know,
my wife's a midwife. Well, she's studying to be one. We've had all of our kids at home.
Well, let me tell you, she's
Actually, in that way, I'm more of a midwife than my wife is, because I've delivered more babies than my wife has, actually.
Well, I really and I mean, I do think that that's what we're doing here.
Yeah,
is that, you know, I mean, and Socrates' mother was a midwife, and that's very much how he saw his role, was that these things were already there, and his job was to midwife it into existence. And, you know, all of there's a great quote from William Gibson that the future exists, it's just unevenly distributed. Mm. And, you know, all these pieces are out there. You know, a lot of the science has been out there for 40 years. Even before that, you know, I mean, many of these ideas are 2,000 or more years old. And so really our job is just to connect the dots and to midwife in this culture. And, you know, it's going to happen. We can just make the process a little bit easier.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being on, Hunter. If people want to get into the dojo, where should they go?
We're very distinguished. We have two iTunes feeds, ooh, one of which is broken. So they should go to Mixed Metal Arts Official.
Oh.
And that's the one that updates regularly. And then
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, well, it's a real.
Is this just happening? This just in?
No, it broke. The feed broke back in July, and we've managed to fix it on like every other platform. Mm. pretty much, but like the iTunes one is still broken. We just have to like get Apple to actually respond to us.
Yeah.
And you know, that's apparently they have other things to think about.
What are they thinking?
Yeah, exactly.
The most important work to be done right here.
Exactly. We just need a Steve Jobs to you know, speak from beyond the grave and be like, fix the Mixed Mental Arts iTunes, dude. Yeah. This is my last will and testament.
This is very important. So people should go there. You have a website too.
Yep, mixedmentalarts.online, which people like Brian and Toya have been helping us build. Like, there's lots of ways to get involved in the community to help move these ideas. And then the Straight A Conspiracy is available on Amazon, on paperback, Kindle, and audiobook on Audible.
Nice. Well, thanks so much, Hunter, for being on. Man, this was, I could talk about all this stuff for hours, and I just really appreciate you coming on and exposing us to all these ideas and diffusing them.
Well, I appreciate that, Edmund. And listen, these ideas made a big difference in my life in making me, I think, a better person. And anything I can do to pay that forward, I'm happy to do. And I think that, you know, there's a really exciting opportunity for a reconciliation between science and religion. And I'm excited to see what emerges and evolves there. And thanks so much for being a part of that.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks, Hunter.
Talk to you soon.